This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host for tonight for a very special edition, Steve Johnson. You can participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests toll-free in the USA and Canada on 1-888-429-5471. As I said, this is a special edition of the show tonight in memorial of the 15th anniversary of the biggest false flag attack on American soil, the September 11 attacks. I'm joined tonight to talk with that... About that with Professor Jim Fetzer, who recently released an all 9/11 book entitled America Nuked on 9/11, Compliments of the CIA, the Neocons in the DOD, and the Mossad. Welcome back to the show, Professor Jim Fetzer, sir.
Oh, hey, I'm great. I'm just delighted to be here. I just watched an absolutely ghastly reconstruction of 9/11 on Fox, which had all kinds of things wrong, very cleverly produced. You had Dick Cheney claiming the Pentagon had hit before he was down in the command and control center, which is contradicted by Norman Mineta's testimony. You had Mark Bingham's mother saying he was calling from an airphone when there were no airphones on 757s in 2001. You had people saying it had all the signature of Osama bin Laden when Osama bin Laden was Colonel Tim Osman operating for the CIA. I mean, the garbage they were shoveling tonight was overwhelming.
We'll be taking audience questions after the first half hour, but my first question to you tonight is, what prompted you to explore the possibility of using nuclear demolition devices for the destruction of the Twin Towers?
Oh, the key indications were the buildings were blowing apart in every direction from the top down, that the buildings were being converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust, that when they were destroyed, there was no massive pile of debris in their footprints. Had it been any kind of collapse, it would have been 12% of the height of the original, as with Building 7, 47-story building, actually did collapse on 5.5 floors behind. They also said during the show on Fox that Building 7 was of poor construction when it was probably the most robust building ever designed by the hand of man. It was erected over two enormous electrical generators. Even in the Twin Towers, the massive steel columns were hollowed out at the center because that provides nearly as much strength as solid steel columns. But in the Building 7, they actually used solid steel columns. I mean, the amount, it was just rubbish. Unbelievable.
Now, the interesting question of the architecture of the Twin Towers and the question we have to ask ourselves is 110 floors coming down in 10 seconds. That's 10 floors every second or thereabouts, or 11 floors a second. Now, what kind of power is needed to reduce those kind of acreage of concrete down to fine particulate dust in real time to make a 10-second collapse? I think if you have the answer to that, then you have the answer to what brought it down. You believe it was well-placed micro-nukes all through the towers themselves?
That's right. That's absolutely right. And in fact, you know, NIST estimated 11 for the North Tower, 9 for the South. The explanation of the difference is as follows. A simple model would be many nukes taking out a cube of floors every 10 floors every 10 every second. So if you're taking out a cube of 10 floors every second in succession from the top down, then when you have 110 floors or 11 cubes, that'll take 11 seconds for the North Tower, because the top three cubes of the South were tilted to the side and taken out as 1-9 for the South, which agrees again with the NIST estimate. But the confirmation that it had been done with mini or micro nukes emerged from the U.S. geological dust studies, which revealed a host of elements that would not have been present had this not been a nuclear event.
Now, people can buy your book at www.moonrockbooks.com, and there's a whole bunch of other fantastic books you've got on sale there. Are you ever going to think about putting in a Jim Fetzer volume where you can buy all of them in a set series?
You know, that's interesting. We'll have to talk about that. My Mike Palachek, my colleague, is the series editor. I edit the books, and we'll discuss that with our business guy and see if a package could be arranged. I think it's an interesting idea because we have books on Sandy Hook, the Boston bombing. I'm going to have a new one from Orlando to Dallas and beyond. There's a book about the moon landings and other issues. So you raise an interesting suggestion.
Now, as far as the nukes that are in the towers, I've done a lot of research on this myself, especially having looked into the 2002 Bali bombings, which a lot of insiders believe was a testing ground, that they basically were testing a new type of technology that they wanted to see what would happen in an urban situation. Do you think it was something similar to what happened in Bali? This kind of nuclear device, as you say, was placed about every 10 floors. Would that have made the kind of destruction that we saw on 9/11 15 years ago today?
When I read the description of the Bali bombing, it struck me immediately that that was done with mini nukes. Yes, absolutely, 100%. Others have suggested that the Mura building in Oklahoma City might have been done with mini or micro nukes. Most certainly it wasn't done by the fertilizer bomb that was parked out in the street. Would have had a relatively negligible effect on that massive building. We have two seismic signatures, one the relatively modest for the fertilizer bomb, the other far, far more massive, where the firemen were even still bringing out unexploded devices they found attached to the core columns. That was a very gruesome event because they even managed to take out a whole, nursery room with a bunch of little kids, I think, to make it more horrific.
Now, one of the misconceptions I think a lot of people have is when you start talking about nukes, they're expecting to see the blinding flash and the nuclear fallout and the huge mushroom cloud. But these micro nukes are specifically low yield to give off very little radiation or a lot of thermobaric temperature rise, and of course a lot of chemical things happening, but not so much as the radiation as the normal nuke that we talk about. Is that correct?
Yeah. We're not talking about Hiroshima, Nagasaki. We're talking about mini or micro nukes that have a dialable radius. So you could set it, for example, at 100 feet, 200 feet on the diameter, put them in the core column. They can be directed upward. There are two ironies here in relation to the work of architects and engineers, which promotes nanothermite based upon some very modest dust samples acquired in an apartment in the vicinity of Ground Zero, the U.S. Geological Survey studied dust from 35 different locations in Manhattan and found barium and strontium, thorium and uranium, lithium, lanthanum, yttrium, chromium, tritium, not only in quantities that were abnormal, but in correlations with one another. Plus, we have the further confirmation of a host of medical maladies, including multiple myeloma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, leukemia, thyroid, pancreatic, brain, esophageal, prostate, and blood and plasma cancers at rates far above normal, which are associated with exposure to ionizing radiation, and where the current estimates have placed the number affected at approaching 70,000.
And of course, there was a New York Sun in 2008 that did a radiological study of Manhattan and found over 60 hotspots, including that at Fresh Kills. So this place had been radiated. There was some huge spike in radiation after 9/11 all over Manhattan. Is that not true?
Yes, that's very, very good, very sophisticated, yes. And, Fresh Kills, they apparently were even bringing in prisoners to clean up, claiming it was asbestos. They were exposing them directly to radioactive contamination. Rudy Giuliani had 115 dump trucks lined up the following day, where Judy Wood has observed they were bringing in hundreds of thousands of tons of dirt. This is what was done at Chernobyl as well to absorb the effects of the radiation, so that for the first several days, the debris pile in New York was actually increasing in volume, not diminishing.
I don't know if you're aware or if you did any research for your book into the claims by Joe Viles, a West Australian researcher who uncovered the use of the special atomic demolition munition, or the backpack nuke, that was used as a demolitions nuke that could be taken on a parachute by any Navy SEAL. So these things were deliverable by parachute. I don't know if you're aware of Joe Viles' work in uncovering that.
I'm a huge fan of Joe Viles. He was the first to notice that the Bureau of Transportation Statistics, which keeps records of every takeoff and landing of every plane in the United States, have no entries for Flight 11 North Tower or Flight 77, the Pentagon, for that day, meaning those planes were not even in the air, where pilots for 9/11 Truth have been able to establish by their study of air-ground communication that Flight 93 was actually over Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, after it had allegedly crashed in Shanksville, and that Flight 175 was over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, long after it had allegedly hit the South Tower, where I obtained Federal Aviation Administration registration records and discovered the planes that were used for those two flights, where the same plane, of course, could be used for many different flights, were not formally deregistered or taken out of service until 28 September 2005, raising the questions, how can planes that were not even in the air have crashed on 9/11, and how can planes that crashed on 9/11 have still been in the air 4 years later? Most Americans are completely unaware, but six or seven of these suicide hijackers turned up alive and well the following day and made contact with the British media. That should lead to the inference that, well, if they're alive and well, then they obviously weren't aboard any planes that crashed, which means that they didn't cause them to crash, which means that passengers aboard them did not die in crashes that did not occur, which means that the whole war on terror is predicated upon a false premise.
You know, Professor Fetzer, when I first heard about nuclear devices being used, when Dmitry Kalazov first came out and made that contention, one of my first stops was to look into any government program that has actually used atomic munitions. And I came across a thing from the 1950s called Operation Plowshare, using specific yield nuclear devices for building dams and building canals and for reducing buildings to very, very quickly and efficiently. And the more I realized, that was in 1950. They've had 60-odd years of development into these concepts and these types of things to have got it right down to a fine art like we saw on 9/11. Do you contend with that, perhaps, that it was a continuation of the government program?
I'm very impressed that you've done this homework. It looks as though the devices that were used were taken from Davy Crockett tactical nukes that were mounted on recoilless rifles and were taken from the U.S. arsenal and given to Israel, which refined them for the purpose of being used to destroy the Twin Towers and were brought back to the United States by some accounts aboard a submarine and then, you know, mounted in the Twin Towers. There was a ACE elevator was allegedly undertaking the greatest elevator renovation project in history, which would have been a perfect cover for emplacing these devices. But we also had a group of so-called Israeli art students who were occupying high floors of the buildings and doing what they called performance art external to the building. And we have photographs of them with boxes full of special kinds of fuse holders that suggest to me they may have had a role in setting up the cutting out of the almost cartoonish plane-shaped holes in the facades of the North and the South Tower, because those weren't caused by any plane. No, any real plane having hit those buildings would have crumpled external to the building, blown apart external to the building. They originally, I'm convinced, planned to use remote-controlled drones. Dov Zakheim, who was the controller of the Pentagon, when they went missing $2.3 trillion, actually had a company with these remote-controlled drones. I think that was the original plan until they discovered they couldn't physically get them all the way into the buildings before they would explode. In fact, this design of those buildings, which won many awards, I mean, very original design, had these 47 massive core columns that were thicker at the base, 6 inches, 5'4" tapered up to the top, and then 284 external steel support columns where they were connected to one another by steel trusses at one end of the core columns, at the other to the external steel support columns, and filled with 4 to 8 inches of concrete. The variance being because the trusses had V-shaped grooves that were 4 inches deep. So in some places it would be four, but others would taper to 8 inches deep. Since the buildings were 208 feet on a side, what you had basically, each floor was an acre of concrete on a steel truss. Now we know what happens when a commercial carrier encounters a small bird weighing a few ounces in flight. It can cause tremendous damage. Well, imagine running into an acre of concrete on a steel truss. And in the case of the South Tower, because of the angle, it was intersecting with 8 different floors consisting of an acre of concrete on a steel truss. In the South Tower, 7, which would have posed enormous horizontal resistance. The aluminum aircraft would have crumpled external to the building and exploded. But that wouldn't work for their fanciful scenarios, since they needed to get the planes all the way inside the building before they exploded to maintain that it was the jet fuel burning at high temperature that caused the steel to weaken and bring about their collapse, all of which was poppycock. In fact, the highest temperature you could attain with a kerosene-based jet fuel would be 1,800 degrees under ideal circumstances, where it's force-fed with pure oxygen. The billowing black clouds coming from the towers showed that they were actually oxygen-deprived fires. Underwriters Laboratories had certified the steel used in the building to 2,000 degrees for 3 to 4 hours without suffering any adverse damage. The government NIST studied 236 samples of steel it had selected from the towers and found 233 had not been exposed to temperatures above 500 degrees Fahrenheit, which is that of an ordinary office fire. The other three not above 12. The fire in the South Tower only burned about an hour, in the North an hour and a half. So these fires burned neither long enough nor hot enough to cause the steel to weaken, much less melt. In fact, the intricate lattice structure meant that it would have been very difficult to heat up any portion of the steel enough to cause it to weaken, because heat is a great dissipator of heat. In other words, the steel is a great dissipator of heat. So you try to heat it up in one place and it's distributed through the entire structure. It's what's known as a heat sink. It'll draw off the heat from any one location. So the whole story was fanciful. Now, they had a timing problem that dictated why they had to fake it. Pilots for 9/11 Truth, when they discovered the scenario of this Boeing 767 approaching, actually at an impossible speed for that altitude, it was approaching at the cruising speed at 35,000 feet. But at 700,000, where these events were taking place, the air is 3 times denser, and the turbines cannot suck the engines through fast enough, and they wind up functioning as brakes. In fact, the speed here was something over 400 miles an hour. Pilots have discovered that the planes would have physically come apart at that speed, at that atmosphere. So the whole thing is a fantasy. But the point is this, that they had set up explosions in the sub-basement that were designed to drain the sprinkler systems. There was a fascinating test of Underwriter Laboratories certification of the steel that occurred in 1975 when they had a huge fire in the North Tower on the 11th floor that burned at about 2,000 degrees for 3 or 4 hours. So it actually was testing Underwriter Laboratories certification, and they did not have to replace the steel. But that is the point at which a decision was made to install a sprinkler system. Now, if the sprinkler system had been in place, it would have put out, extinguished the very modest fires that remained after the spectacular fireballs, which were a pre-positioned fuel, possibly even napalm, had consumed themselves in the first 15 or 20 seconds. The sprinkler system would have put out the very modest fires that remained, which would have meant, of course, that there was no rationale to explain their collapse. So they set off explosions in the sub-basements of the North and the South Tower that were timed to coincide with the impact of the plane, so they could explain this on the basis of jet fuel falling through the elevator shafts. I discovered what had happened there when Willie Rodriguez, who is a senior custodian in the North Tower, came here to Madison, where I now reside, and gave a talk. And while we were having dinner afterwards, he talked about watching the sub-basements fill with water. And I realized that the purpose of those explosions was to drain the sprinkler systems of water so they couldn't extinguish those very modest fires. But to do that, they had to coordinate the hits of the planes, which were all controlled because they were faked, with the explosions, and they got it wrong. Craig Furlong and Gordon Ross discovered that the explosions in the sub-basements of the North and the South Tower occurred 14 and 17 seconds too early to have been the result of jet fuel falling through the elevator shafts, which was an improbable scenario anyway, because these were like 330-story buildings in their core, which had elevators that came down for 30 floors. Then you'd have to get off elevators, go down 30 floors, then you'd get off. There are only a couple that were maintenance elevators that would go from top to bottom. And in fact, Willie had a fellow custodian trapped in one of those. Had jet fuel fallen through them, he would have been killed, but he survived.
Now, has anything NIST ever said, or any of the reports have ever put out, have they ever said anything that's actually true, that you can say, well, actually, that's correct?
I think they got the time estimates right. That, you know, the 11 seconds does appear to be the duration of the demolition of the North Tower, 9 of the demolition of the South. But they're talking about a collapse scenario that was actually impossible with given the design and construction of the towers. For example, above the hit point of the North Tower were 14 floors. Chuck Baldwin, who's a retired high school math, physics, and chemistry instructor, has done very thorough analysis of the design of the buildings. And for the top 14 floors to represent 1.4% of the mass of the steel. The idea that 1.4% of the mass of the steel could overwhelm the lower 98.6 is an absurdity. Not only that, but he's calculated for every unit down from those 14 floors, there were 199 units up. In other words, there was overwhelmingly more support to maintain all the floors in place. Plus, if there had been any kind of collapse, then you would have had a massive pile of debris in the footprint. But there's nothing there. I actually had Father Frank Morales, who is a first responder from St. Mark's Episcopal Church, on my own radio show twice, during which both times he explained that those buildings were demolished to or even below ground zero, ground level. And we even have a photograph, one of my favorites, of Building 6 with this huge scooped out center. And in the background to the left, you can see the massive pile of debris from Building 7, the 5.5 floors, and the immediate right foreground where Building 1 stood, although it was more than twice as tall, and therefore had a collapse, would have had a debris pile more than twice as high, actually 13 or 14 floors. There's nothing there. So right. That you know, anyone who wants to maintain that there was any kind of collapse is simply blowing smoke. And in fact, the NIST had to admit that they could never come up with any cause for the initiation of a collapse. The whole thing is an utter fantasy. But Americans are generally so, you know, unknowing about matters technical, about engineering or aerodynamics or physics, that the government just made up a story they thought they could market to the public and the public would believe it. And here they were tonight, even on Fox, trying to reinforce it. You have many of the perps who were involved who were speaking, like Condoleezza Rice. She was speaking there. Donald Rumsfeld was speaking. Dick Cheney was speaking. I mean, these are three of the major perps in bringing about the events of 9/11, whereas Michael Rupert established in his magisterial work, Crossing the Rubicon, based not on scientific, but on, public sources, newspaper reports and so forth. The executive director on 9/11 appears to have been Dick Cheney himself.
Well, I'd like to see where is Dov Zakheim? Where is Jerome Hauer? Where is Zellico these days? You know, where are these cheerleaders for all this garbage and the stories that they sell?
I'm sure they're prospering, you know. I mean, it's really deplorable. But I'm very impressed with the amount of research you've done on 9/11. That's excellent.
Well, it's the watershed moment of all of us, you know. And if we've got kids to bring into this world, we want them to be brought up in a world of truth.
Right. We know that all four of the alleged crash sites were fabricated or fake, albeit in different ways. So I did a 2-hour discussion about the crash sites with Major General Albert Stubblebine, U.S. Army retired, who was formerly in charge of all U.S. military signals and photographic intelligence. In other words, he was the head of U.S. photographic intelligence. And we went through all the evidence I was presenting. He not only agreed with me about the faking of all four of the crash sites, he added additional reasons why what I was explaining was correct. And any of your listeners can find that online by doing a search on the Real Deal episode, just EP, number sign, 100. The Real Deal episode number 100, the 9/11 crash sites, and you'll turn it up. And you'll have 2 hours of review of the evidence about how they fabricated and faked each one of the four crash sites. The most challenging case, of course, being Flight 175, as I've been sketching for you here. I mean, as soon as you see the plane effortlessly disappearing into the South Tower, you know something is completely wrong, because that wasn't possible. We have done frame-by-frame analysis of two of the key videos, the Hezer Connie taken from the side and the Evan Fairbanks taken looking straight up, and the plane disappears. It passes through its whole length into this massive building in the same number of frames it passes through its whole length in air. So unless a 500,000-ton steel and concrete building provides no more resistance to the trajectory of an aircraft than air, something is completely wrong. And the fact is, we were being subjected to one or another form of video fakery, where there are three different theories about how it was done. Rosalie Grable, a New York resident recently deceased, also known as the Web Fairy, suggested it was done with computer-generated images. Ace Baker from Southern California has suggested it was done with video compositing. During the 17-second interval between the film is shot and it's actually broadcast, you could add images. Ace believes that's how it was done. The third theory was advanced by Richard Hall from the UK, who has a video you can find online entitled Richard Hall's Flight 175 3D Radar Study, where he adopted the following method. He looked at the many videos we have. There are perhaps 52 of Flight 175. He found 27 were sufficiently precise that he could plot locations and times for the plane, let us call it, approaching the building. He found NIST had the same plots of the same locations, the same times, claimed it was from radar data. But when he inspected their study, it looked suspicious. He discovered independently, however, that there actually was radar data, except that the plane recorded on the radar was 1,200 feet to the right of the images in the video, which led him to hypothesize that we're talking about is a holographic image being projected from this real aircraft 1,200 feet to the side of the projected image, that it had to travel faster than was aerodynamically possible for a Boeing 767 in order to retain the coherence of the hologram as viewed from the ground. And when it flew past the South Tower, of course, the image just disappeared into the building because there was no resistance, physical resistance to an image. And indeed, he applied the same analysis to the North Tower with similar results, and believes that the way the cutouts were done was beneath the initial cloud of dust and debris. In the case of the North Tower in particular, you can see a whole lot of little points of light. And that's where I think the gelatin group may have come in by setting it up using thermite, nanothermite, whatever, to cut out this cookie cutter-like image of a plane. I've often wondered whether that's what George H.W. Bush meant when he talked about 1,000 points of light.
Wow. You know, you mentioned a few names there just earlier. There's two others I would gladly give mention to. Gerard Holmgren from Australia and Genghis 6199, who put out a series called 9/11 Taboo, a four-part series going into crash physics and showing that there was no resistance whatsoever from the planes as they went into the building. Yeah. The contention of Dmitry Kalazov was, in fact, that these planes were some type of converted granite missile that were taken from the Kursk submarine. A year earlier, in 2000, the Russian submarine that went to the bottom of the Atlantic, I believe it was, and they tried to get him out, and they couldn't, and all these sailors died. About 28 sailors died in the Kursk. Well, apparently, these missiles, there were three missiles taken from the submarine when they managed to resurface it. His contention is that they used one of these granite missiles to test the newly renovated area of the Pentagon to see if it was up to the latest Russian technology. That was the purpose of it, and it certainly showed that it was something that punched through many, many layers of reinforced concrete and steel at the Pentagon.
Let me talk about that. Dmitry, of course, has proposed that was a 150 kiloton Newton in the sub-basement directed upward, which would have had the effect of blowing the building from the bottom up, not from the top down. And, you know, I think it's indefensible on multiple grounds, but I do think he's a brilliant guy. Now, when it comes to the Pentagon, this was another fantasy that was being presented tonight in this Fox retrospective about 9-1-1. They were showing the approach of the plane to the Pentagon, which is over 500 miles an hour, barely skimming the ground. I have a chapter by an aeronautical engineer in the America Nuked on 9-11, proving this is aerodynamically impossible. Because what's known as a ground effect, also downdraft, I mean, these are interacting phenomena that would have made it impossible for a Boeing 757, which was the type of plane for the Pentagon and for Shanksville.
Yeah, supposedly.
It couldn't have gotten closer closer than 60 or even 80 feet to the ground, where 80 feet is higher than the Pentagon is tall. I just mentioned another two points, by the way, from this Fox special. You had Mark Bingham's mother say that Mark said he was calling on an air phone, but there were no air phones in Boeing 757 in 2001. They also cited Ted Olson, who gave three different stories of his wife having called him. First claimed it was with cell phones. But at the altitudes and speed, cell phone contact would have been impossible. He then said it was with an air phone, not knowing that, in fact, there were no air phones in 757s. I mean, the whole thing is such rubbish. And here you got the guy who is the number three in the Department of Justice, the Solicitor General who represents the United States before the Supreme Court in arguments, who has said on other occasions he could think of infinitely many reasons why the government would be entitled to lie to the people. Just as he was doing here about 9-11. Barbara, by the way, according to him, and incidentally, the FBI has confirmed that there was no through contact between Barbara Olson and Ted on 9-11, claimed that all the passengers had been herded to the back of the plane. But if you think about it, that throws off the aerodynamics because it doesn't have the right balance. It would have made it very difficult to fly the plane. In any case, it's not only aerodynamically impossible to have a 757 just barely skimming the ground at over 400 miles an hour, but if it had been taking out a series of lampposts, as the government claims, the effect of a plane traveling over 400 miles an hour taking out stationary lampposts would be the same as if the plane were stationary and was taken out by lampposts traveling 400 miles an hour. It would have ripped the wings open. The fuel stored there would have mixed with the oxygen, burst into flame. It would have cartwheeled across the lawn, made a terrible mess. But we have all kinds of photographs of the Pentagon immediately after the alleged hit. One of my favorites is you have the two civilian lime green fire engines that just happened to be in the vicinity, extinguishing the very modest fires. And the Pentagon is perfectly clear, green, unblemished. I mean, you expect Tiger to show up to practice his putting. He's, of course, not even on the golf course these days. But there was a time that would have been perfect. It's completely ridiculous. Plus, the hit point is only about 10 feet high, 16 or 17 feet wide. There's chain link fence, a couple of automobiles, two enormous spools of cable, unbroken windows around the hit point. But what is not there is an enormous pile of aluminum debris from a 100-ton airliner. No bodies, no seats, no luggage, no tail, no wings.
Like peanuts.
Not even the engines were recovered from the Pentagon, if you can believe. I mean, this is so ridiculous. It's unreal. They want us to believe all this? Jamie McIntyre from CNN was on the scene and was asked by his anchor about, you know, the plane having crashed. And he said, well, you know, you might think that, but from my close-up inspection, there's no sign of any plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. And for that, he was reprimanded and had to retract it. And he did it in the following ingenious way. He said, only a fool would deny that a plane had hit the Pentagon, meaning his saying the truth at the time was foolish of him if he expected to keep his job. I think he couldn't tolerate carrying the lies for the government, and he retired from business. He was the best reporter they had.
One of the biggest litmus tests I find on 9/11 truthers is if they say the taboo words and the taboo topics about who really did pull off the Pentagon.
Yeah,
Rabbi
sure.
Zachheim and the Zionist agenda that was behind the neocon plan.
Right. Right,
and
right.
A lot of 9/11 truthers I've interviewed, for example, David Chandler, the architect for engineers, when I mentioned the five dancing Israelis, he refuted that he'd even heard of any Israeli involvement whatsoever. And I was like, wow, and this guy's got books on 9/11? They claim they've never heard of Israeli involvement? That to me is a big litmus test. Would you say so in
9/11 truth? Of course. Would you believe that architects and engineers for 9/11 truth, which has to have received hundreds of millions in donations from sympathetic but gullible Americans in the belief that they were actually going to try to solve the crime. Because I make that estimate because at Sandy Hook, the 26 families who were faking to have lost children have received between 27 and 130 million. So if you got between 27 and 130 million being donated over the loss of 20 kids and 6 adults, none of whom died, by the way. The school had been closed in 2008. It was loaded with asbestos and other biohazards. It was going to have to be brought into compliance with American for Disability Act laws, but it was too expensive, so they abandoned the school. If you look at a photograph of the parking lot of Sandy Hook, you can see what's wrong. They still were not compliant with ADA. You don't have the familiar blue and white parking spaces, blue and white signage for handicap only. You got wooden stairways that no wheelchair could navigate, meaning it couldn't even have legally operated as a school in 2012. Not only that, but it was a 28-degree Fahrenheit ground temperature day. If the school were operating, you would have seen heat and steam rising from the building. But in fact, the boilers were so decrepit, they were no longer functional. So it was a cold building. Not only that, but you see the rows of vehicles in the middle. They're all parked facing the school. But that's ridiculous. According to the driving instruction, you come up Dickinson Drive, take a right, turn, curl around, and then park facing away from the school. But since they were only going to be using them as props, it was easier to bring them in a single file and put them in 2x2x2x2 facing the school. So just from looking at a photograph of the Sandy Hook parking lot, if you know what to look for, you can discern that it was a fraud. Well, if they got 130 mil for over 20 kids and 6 adults, how much are Americans going to dole out for the death of 3,000 Americans in the greatest attack in the history of the United States? To the organization that pretends to be out to solve the problem. And would you believe, as you're actually hinting, they will not address who was responsible and why. In fact, it's a wonder they even ever talk about the Pentagon. In fact, the Associates of Architects and Engineers and of Steve Jones and of the Journal of 9/11 Studies have published articles claiming that a plane, a Boeing 757, actually did hit the Pentagon, which is complete rubbish, as I've already explained, where even the official trajectory wasn't aerodynamically possible. I mean, this is embarrassing that you have this organization posing as the leading truth group to sort out what happened, and they won't even talk about who was responsible and why. As you are properly implying, actually, the scheme for 9/11 appears to have originated in the fertile imagination of Bibi Netanyahu, who wanted to figure out a way to draw the United States into wars against the modern Arab states that served as a counterbalance to Israel's domination of the region. He actually held a conference on terrorism in Jerusalem and published a book entitled Terrorism, How the West Can Win in 1987, before anyone had even thought about terrorism. With the demise of the Soviet Union in 1990-91, a neocon think tank called Project for a New American Century began advancing the position that there was a unique historical opportunity here to create a new American empire that would span the globe and endure for the next 100 years. If only the United States would move aggressively into the Middle East and exert diplomatic and military pressure outward from that geopolitically sensitive area. They bemoaned, however, that the American people might be slow to appreciate the opportunity thereby presented, unless there were some traumatic catalyzing event such as a new Pearl Harbor. They went about creating it. Zionists in the Port Authority transferred to private hands for the first time, the World Trade Center. It had two enormous white elephants. The Twin Towers actually were laden with asbestos. They were under directives from the Port Authority. It had to be removed, but it could not be done by a conventional demolition because that would release all the asbestos particles into the atmosphere. It couldn't be done except at an exorbitant expense by constructing steel scaffolding around 110-story buildings. But how convenient if, after it comes into the hands of Larry Silverstein just 6 weeks before, he fires the security firm that's been looking after the World Trade Center since it was first opened in 1970 and arranges a new insurance policy that has a terrorist attack clause where, claiming that were two planes and therefore two attacks, he gets double indemnity and pockets over $4.5 billion on a $114 million investment. I mean, it's completely grotesque, but now they have the buildings completely destroyed, and he can, you know, rebuild a World Trade Center 1 that doesn't have the occupancy problems because, I mean, they just didn't have enough tenants. So it was a perfect way, you know, to abolish a World Trade Center, get something more economically efficient, give the motivation, you know, make the American people think they're under attack by a foreign power. Hitler and Goebbels observed that it's easy to get the people to go along. All you have to do is convince them they're under attack by a foreign power, and they'll gladly surrender their liberties to gain the security the government promises to provide. That's exactly what happened on 9/11. They had to include the Pentagon, by the way, because that was our military command and control center, and it was because the Pentagon was hit. I mean, it was all fake. We had what appears to have been a global hawk that approached the building and fired a missile into the West Wing, where Donald Rumsfeld had had the section chief bring all the budget analysts, the accountants, the financial experts, together with the records to track the missing $2.3 trillion he had announced was missing the day before. So it killed the experts and destroyed the records. In fact, I was astonished when I went through the casualty list for the Pentagon, which had 125 names, including three dozen of these accountants and budget experts. I mean, this was very cleverly contrived to not only fake an attack on the Pentagon, but to get rid of the records for the missing $2.3 trillion. And, of course, yep. As you observed, Dov Zakheim, who is a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen, that's where most of the members of the Project for the New American Century, who, when Bush and Cheney came into office, moved into the Department of Defense and assumed high-ranking positions. I'm talking about people like Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle and Douglas Feith. General Richard Myers was involved. Rudy Giuliani was involved. Larry Silverstein. I mean, it's really shocking how these traitors betrayed the United States to advance a political agenda to benefit Israel.
Now, I'm sure you would agree, when people say that 9/11 was an inside job or Israel did 9/11, it's not as simple as that. That there are far more factions and far more other things at play, and your book goes into that. Your book actually names the names and those who were involved and the companies that were side issues to that. Like a pyramid, it was on a need-to-know basis, and those at the bottom didn't need to know. They just did their job. Is that not true?
That's exactly right. That's just what I said to Ollie North when he was sitting in for Sean Hannity in late June of 2006. You can still find the interview online. I had been lured onto the show by a producer who said they wanted to learn what we had discovered about 9/11 since I had founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth in December of 2005. And while I was waiting in the room, I had a TV set brought in so I could see how they were pitching it. And as soon as they said, this was Alan Combs, "You won't believe what your kids are learning from their professors." I knew this was a complete setup. They had somehow formed the opinion that I was offering a course on 9/11, which was untrue. They didn't know enough to get it right. I had courses in critical thinking where I would use 9/11 as an illustration. So it was not that I wasn't talking about 9/11, but I had no course. So when they brought me in and the first question was, are students required to take this course? I said, I'm afraid you have your facts foxed, because I do not teach a course. I created an organization, a society, Scholars for 9/11 Truth, to do research, but I have no such course. And Alan Combs acted stunned when Ollie North came in, sitting in for Sean Hannity. He asked, now, let me get this straight. Didn't you tell our producer that you were teaching a course on this? I said, no, I did not. I'm not teaching such a course. He said, do you know of any courses being taught on this? I said, no, frankly, I know of no such course. But I said, but it's a great idea, because there's a tremendous amount of material there, and I would certainly support such a course being taught. And at one point, Ollie asked me, well, you know, they asked me, did I have any, Alan Combs actually asked this, did I have any evidence of anyone in the administration having actually been involved in 9/11, such as, for example, Dick Cheney? And I said, of course. And I proceeded to explain how Norman Mineta, the Secretary of Transportation, had been in an underground bunker with Cheney, how an aide had come up to Cheney and said, sir, it's 50 miles out, then come back, sir, it's 40 miles out, sir, it's 30 miles out, asked him, do the orders still stand? And Cheney stood up and whipped his head around, said, of course, have you heard anything to the contrary? Norman Mineta didn't understand what he was hearing or witnessing at the time, but this was a plane that was approaching the Pentagon, which therefore contradicts, you know, Cheney's claim on this Fox thing tonight, that the Pentagon had already been hit by the time he got down into this command and control center, this underground bunker. What Mineta didn't understand was that it was in order to not shoot down the approaching plane. Now, if they were actually being used as weapons, then, of course, the thing to do would have been to shoot it down, because while you lose the plane and the passengers, you do not lose the property and the personnel at the target. Instead, it was, of course, allowed to approach the Pentagon. It had to be emitting ID on its transponder. Otherwise, the Pentagon, which is the most heavily defended building in the world, would have shot it down. And then it performed a flyover. It didn't hit the Pentagon. It flew over the Pentagon. In fact, I have a friend from JFK Research, Roy Schaefer, who had a trucker buddy by the name of Dave Ball, who was in front of the Pentagon at the time. And Dave told Roy how he had watched a commercial plane fly right toward the building and then swerve over it. And yet he continued to believe that a plane had hit the Pentagon. This is because there was an explosion that was corresponding with the approach of the plane to create the subliminal impression, depending on your point of view, that actually the plane had hit the Pentagon, but it had not. Very thorough research on what happened on the Pentagon has been done by Dennis Camino, which you can find in another Real Deal episode entitled Raising the Smoke Curtain at the Pentagon. I mean, just do a search on The Real Deal, Raising the Smoke Curtain at the Pentagon. And if you want more about who was responsible and why, Dennis and I coincidentally did 2 hours going through all the roles of all the different Zionist factions, how ICTS, for example, an Israeli security firm, was working the airports where the planes allegedly originated, and on from there, identifying all the key players by name, very specifically, including the five dancing Israelis, who, of course, were observed in Liberty State Park, you know, giving each other high fives and filming the destruction of the Twin Towers, which a neighbor who observed them thought was very peculiar, notified the state police. When they were arrested, the driver said to the arresting officer, we are not the problem. Our problem is your problem. The problem is the Palestinians. They found residue of explosive, passports, money, box cutters in this van. It was from Urban Moving Systems. It even had a mural on the side of a plane hitting the... It's just ludicrous. These guys were apprehended and held for 41 days until an assistant to then Attorney General John Ashcroft, who was also featured in this Fox thing, directed their release. They went back to Israel. Three of them went on Israeli TV and explained they'd been there to document the destruction of the Twin Towers, obviously implying foreknowledge, where the official who directed their release was none other than Michael Chertoff, who had become the second director of Homeland Security and be responsible for giving us TSA and all these scanners that have never been tested for their safety for Americans who are getting radiated by uncertified mechanism for the sake of national security, making him billions of dollars in the process.
Okay, given this evidence, the overwhelming evidence of Israeli involvement, I'm going to give you four choices, and you tell me who you think was the mastermind of 9/11, Ehud Barak, Benjamin Netanyahu, Dick Cheney, or D, all of the above.
Well, they were certainly all involved, but I do believe it originated with Bibi Netanyahu.
The mastermind of 9/11.
Yeah, if you had to single out a single person, but Cheney was actually running it, and Ehud was participating in organizing it. I mean, they brought in over 200 Mossad agents masquerading as art students. They had groups of them who were trailing the Patsies. The Saudis basically were only involved, it appears, in giving financing, some money for all of this. Of course, 15 of the alleged 19 were from Saudi Arabia. None were from Iraq.
They were Israeli. They weren't from Saudi Arabia. They were Israelis pretending to be Saudis. That's easy enough.
Oh, well, that may be. I mean, they were identified, yes, as the Saudis, and it may very well be. Now Saudi Arabia has roughly been thrown under the bus. We have this, law that's been generated by the 38 pages that have been withheld that concerns Saudi funding for 9/11 that allows American citizens to sue Saudi Arabia. The Saudis by the way, when all the aircraft were put down on 9/11, Norman Mineta issued the order. Nevertheless, special flights were arranged to take members of the Saudi royal family, including the Bin Laden family, back to Saudi Arabia. I mentioned before, in case anyone missed it, Osama bin Laden was working for the CIA. He was our man in Afghanistan. He was instrumental in getting the Stingers to the resistance that were used to shoot down the Soviet helicopters and planes. His name in the agency was Colonel Tim Osman. He was actually being treated for his kidney problems in a hospital in Dubai not long before his death on 15 December 2001 in Afghanistan, where he was buried in an unmarked grave. There were local obituaries. Interestingly, Fox News actually on the 26th published an article you can still find online. Bin Laden reported dead, talking about the local obituaries. In the meanwhile, Nick Kohlerstrom from the UK has published an article, Osama bin Laden, 1957 to 2001, and David Ray Griffin, the dean of 9/11 research, who now has, I think, a dozen books. His most recent is about to appear, all about Dick Cheney's role on 9/11. Has a book entitled Osama bin Laden, Dead or Alive, just bringing together all the evidence. He actually died on 15 December. But you see, it was convenient politically to keep him alive. They faked tapes. They faked images. They had on this Fox thing several obvious faked images of Osama, the word Osama, at all. And in fact, when Osama was first told about 9/11, he explained that he had nothing to do with it. That was contrary to the tenets of Islam, to murder innocent women and children. That it was obvious that there was a government within the government that wanted to blame this on Muslims. And indeed, no less an authority than William Jefferson Clinton himself has said there's a government within the government and that he, Bill Clinton, did not control it. So Osama was on firm ground. It was very convenient for Barack Obama to resurrect him and kill him a second time in a compound in Pakistan. The whole thing was a hoax. He was receiving criticism. This is Obama, was receiving criticism because Guantanamo is still open, and for having troops stationed in Pakistan. And his birth certificate was a hot issue at the time. So they claimed that the tip had come from Guantanamo. Oh, gee, aren't we glad it's open after all. He used troops stationed in Pakistan. Gee, I guess it's good they were there anyway. And then triumphantly claimed to have taken out Osama and positioned himself for a triumphal re-election. Norman Mineta actually blew the whistle because there's this very famous photograph that went around the world of the Obama cabinet, including Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden, intensely looking at a big screen TV, which was supposed to be them watching this action go down in real time. But Leon Panetta, who is then the director of the CIA, observed there had been no live coverage for the first 20, 25 minutes, which was the entire lapse time of the operation. The whole thing was just another propaganda trick, which is all we get from the administration any longer. Since 9/11, the government has been using the media as an instrument of propaganda. The National Defense Appropriations Act of 2013 actually rescinded the Smith-Mundt Act of 1948 that precluded the use of the same techniques of disinformation and propaganda within the United States who are being used outside. And that, I think, was much of the cover for the Sandy Hook, where Eric Holder was deeply involved in organizing Sandy Hook. We have a school principal, actually a superintendent of schools from the L.A. area, Paul Preston, who has actually supervised drills like this before. He was so troubled by what he saw being broadcast from Sandy Hook that he reached out to his contacts in the Obama administration, all of whom told him that it had been a drill, that no one had died, and that was done to promote gun control. We have even discovered the FEMA manual for the two-day exercise, which I included as Appendix A in the book. San Bernardino was another fake. We discovered the Craigslist ad for extras at San Bernardino. It said good pay, food, transportation, some speaking roles, call date December 1st, going live December 2nd. I mean, it goes on and on and on. This is ridiculous. Our government has become the biggest liar in the world.
And the use of propaganda, for sure. You know, very interestingly, at the time of that SEAL team attack on the Pakistan compound of the supposed Osama, my uncle was getting married over there at the time, and he heard what was going on. This was, in fact, a raid by the Pakistan Army on a CIA safe house that went terribly, terribly wrong for the Americans, and they had to evacuate and leave it. So what we got told in the West was completely different what was happening on there on the ground.
Yes, 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 I know. Absolutely, you're correct, 100%. As I believe I explained, I'm doing another show at the top of the hour, but I can come back after that. In other words, if we take an hour break, I can come back again if you would like to have me back after an hour, sort of leapfrogging from one show to another.
Yeah, sure. We'll get in touch with the producers and see what the schedule is. But certainly, we've got so much to talk about, especially with the... I want to get back to the nukes and how they were put in there. You say that these were Davy Crockett types that came from the Dimona nuclear plant in the Negev Desert. Is that correct?
Well, these were Davy Crockett warheads that were from the American arsenal that were given to Israel for them to refine and rework to use for this purpose. But very, the cat says, see, In three minutes, I have a commitment to do the other show, and then I can come back in an hour to address further questions. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, sure. I think we only have an hour on this show anyway. I'll get back to you.
Right? Okay, Rob. Well, look, I'll come back again sometime if you want.
Certainly.
Well, I can't stay longer tonight. That's unfortunate, but there it is, you know. Okay.
We'll try for coming back later. Thanks very much for being on the show today, Professor. It's been fantastic.
Yeah, okay. I'll check in with you. You ring me up in one hour, right at the top of the hour, and we'll reconnect.
Roger that. It's been great to have you, and people can get your book from moonrockbooks.com. Is that correct?
Exactly right. Moonrockbooks.com. Yeah, and the Sandy Hook, Boston bombing, Moon Book, a whole bunch of stuff there. Check it out. I think there's something there that should appeal to virtually everyone if you care about the truth of our own history, because our government has been doing nothing but lying about every aspect, including the claim that we put men on the moon.
Absolutely. Stay tuned for other special guests coming up on the BBS radio show, The People Speak Show, coming soon. Big thanks go out to the admins, Earth Play and Love is Light, the producers, Mike, Doug, and Donald, to the assisting admins, and everyone, to all my friends throughout the world, and all the guys who give me so much support. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You can tune into my own channel on YouTube called Stop Funding Israel. But for me for now, take care, and bye until next time.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff. speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. I'm your host again for tonight, Steve Johnson. Welcome back, everyone. And joining us live is Professor Fetzer. Your new book is called America Nuked on 9/11, Compliments of the CIA, the Neocons, and the DOD, and the Mossad. Welcome back to the show, Professor Jim Fetzer, sir.
Real pleasure. I've been very impressed by the extent of your knowledge of 9/11. You've obviously done your homework. As a professor, I appreciate students who do their homework, and believe me, there are an awful lot, even members of the 9/11 community, who do not do their homework.
Well, questioning things comes naturally to somebody who's had to ask questions all their life. My father, being a senior U.S. serviceman in the Vietnam conflict, as a son of a serviceman, you know, and then learning about the Vietnam conflict being a lie, it just inspired me to seek more and more about how much other stuff they lie about.
Yeah.
And it seems with the Iraq war and everything that's happening, that their lies just keep compounding and compounding, and the false flags are getting sloppier. Would you not agree?
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, absolutely. I think they're becoming more and more arrogant because they see the American people are so uncritical, they'll just accept anything the government says as long as they're getting it from all the different networks are saying the same thing. They believe it. They don't have the imagination to realize it could all be propaganda, that they're all working after the same script, that there are only five or six corporations that control 95% of what we hear, that the Associated Press and Reuters are the source of all the non-local news, and that the Reuters actually owns the Associated Press, where Reuters, in turn, appears to be owned by the Rothschilds. So it's really not the case that we have a whole lot of independent sources of news anymore.
Uh-huh. What kind of responses have you had from people about your new book? What kind of feedback have you got from them so far?
Oh, just tremendous enthusiasm for getting the truth out, and, you know, in such detail and scope. It's gratifying, because I think this is a book that has the potential to make a difference. This is, my 33rd book, and I'll tell you, I think it's by far the most important.
For those people who say that it's obvious you're some kind of a Mason, can you dispel that right now?
Some kind of Mason?
Yeah, a Freemason yourself.
You're kidding me. Why would anyone think that? That's simply ridiculous. Look, if you want to know my history, I was born in Pasadena in 1940. You can see the Rose Bowl from the Huntington Memorial where I was born. I grew up in Southern California. I graduated from South Pasadena High School. My brother and I were the only two members of the same family to ever receive the Carver Award, which was the school highest award for moral leadership. I was on a Navy regular scholarship to Princeton, where I graduated magna cum laude, in philosophy. Princeton at the time was number one in the world in physics, math, and philosophy. I did my undergraduate thesis for the world's leading philosopher of science, Carl G. Hempel. I went into the Marine Corps, commissioned as a second lieutenant, served 4 years, including 13 months in the Far East, but not in Vietnam, both training ops all over in Korea, Japan, several times.
Certainly not to credit your credibility or question your credentials, but I just noticed it was your 33rd book. You know, that's quite a number there, 33rd.
I didn't shoot for 35, you know, because I had a career, academic career of 35 years. So I wanted to have the equivalent of one book for each of the years I've served. And I'm going to make it because I've got two more in the works right now already, which will be 34 and 35. 34 is on From Orlando to Dallas and Beyond, and 35 is about JFK. So, you know.
Have you had any negative responses from anyone from the book that you've offended?
Did the guy cancel or something?
Hey, I'm here.
What's going on, y'all?
I'm here. Can you hear? Steve, you got it?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Do you hear this person asking?
Oh, that was in the chat room there. Yeah, apparently it's not coming through the live feed from BBS Radio.
Very strange.
I just had the mic unmuted in the room, so somebody just took the mic and asked about the rest of the show.
Whether I'm here, and I am here, but they maybe aren't hearing me. I don't know. Are they hearing me? I don't know.
No, I can't. If I take the mic in that room, we'll get a terrible echo. It'll feed back.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, I didn't
My question being, have you had any negative responses from the book? Have you freaked anybody out with this information going, oh, my God, what's he writing about now?
Not the public. You know, what's very interesting is that there are people within the 9/11 community who are being criticized here. Because, of course, I point out that Judy Wood and Dews are unwilling to take into account all the evidence produced by the U.S. Geological Survey about the barium, strontium, and all that, which show that it was a nuclear event. They don't want to acknowledge that. So instead of adjusting their beliefs, they attack me. In particular, I published a review of Judy's book in May of 2012, before the Vancouver hearings. I gave her a 5-star review for bringing together this massive, impressive body of evidence. Pointed out, however, that while she had shown that big nukes hadn't done the job, that she hadn't ruled out mini or micro nukes. I then conducted the hearings in Vancouver, and a great deal of evidence substantiating the use of mini or micro nukes was produced. I came back to discover that I'd been attacked thousands of times by followers of Judy. Now, this is for my review of her book, not her book. For my review of her book. So I revised the review and downgraded it to a 3-star and put in the barium, strontium, and all that to demonstrate it was a nuclear event, because she is being unscientific by not adjusting her theories to the new evidence, which, you know, shows that it's a kind of a political movement, a limited hangout. She, of course, won't talk about who is responsible and why. And would you believe that as of the last time I looked, which was, I don't know, a week or 10 days ago, there had been 7,500 attacks on my review of her book. I mean, I can't tell you how absurd this is. And then the others who balk are all those associated with architects and engineers, because architects and engineers is promoting nanothermite. I have here 3 chapters with Mark Hightower that demonstrate that nanothermite cannot have been responsible for blowing apart the buildings. But Steve Jones, Kevin Ryan, and all those people don't want to admit it. So they too, you know, these have been more of attacks on me. Actually in a forum on Truth and Shadows that reveal their attitudes. You know, they don't want to look at evidence for a theory other than their preferred theory, which shows that they're unscientific, non-objective. I mean, this is my area, right? I'm a professional philosopher of science. I teach and publish. I mean, when all those books on on the nature of scientific reasoning. They're perfectly objective criteria, rules of reasoning, where the reason why you would get consensus within the scientific community is they're applying the same rules of reasoning to the same body of evidence in relation to the same alternative hypotheses. So the only way they can preserve their dew hypothesis or nanothermite is by excluding evidence that contradicts it. But neither of those organizations is willing to talk about who is responsible and why. I cannot imagine a more pointless effort than to have a 9/11 research group that's not willing to address who is responsible and why.
Now, just today, there was a 9/11 event that you attended. Can you tell us a bit more about that and who attended and who spoke at it? Can you tell us a bit more about it?
I'm sure what you're talking about is the second Midwest 9/11 Truth Conference. Now, a couple of years ago, Stephen Francis and I organized the first Midwest 9/11 Truth Conference with only three speakers in Champaign-Urbana. But as we were approaching the 15th, it seemed obvious that it was the time for a second. But I had the following thoughts about it. Instead of having everyone go to the trouble of fly to the same location, pay for accommodation and all, they give talks that are then recorded in order to get out their recorded presentations, why not just record them in advance directly and then put them together as a conference? So that's what I did. Saturday, I put up 14 sessions for the Midwest 9/11 Truth Conference, and it really came out extraordinarily well. Part one and part two are available already on my blog at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com. And we've got an introduction and a session about who is responsible and why to set things off. And then I have Chuck Baldwin, who is a retired high school physics, math, and chemistry instructor, going through the design of the buildings and showing how they could not possibly have collapsed. I've got T. Mark Hightower, the expert on nanothermite. I've got Charles Pegolo, who's a civil and structural engineer, talking about why it has to have been nukes. I've got Joe Olson, a licensed, currently practicing civil and structural engineer, explain how it's without any doubt it's nukes. I got Don Fox offering more discussion about the U.S. Geological Survey results, and I got Dennis Camino about the Pentagon. Then the second part is addressing, who was responsible. And I have another extremely good lineup for part two, where I'm going to pull it up right now. So I don't get people out of sequence, including Susan Lindauer, who was a CIA asset to Saddam Hussein, who explains how Saddam was so eager to avoid war with the United States that he offered to buy 1 million cars a year for the next 10 years. And then he added, as she was about to leave, if that's not enough, make it 20. Scott Bennett, who was a U.S. Army intelligence and PSYOP guy, who began blowing the whistle, and as a consequence, they incarcerated him for 2 years in a prison. But ironically, he was incarcerated with a Swiss banker who was at the heart of all the scandals, the financial aspects of 9/11, a guy named Brad Birkenfeld. So he's published a book called Shell Game. He's notified the Congress of all of his discoveries. Really powerful stuff. But needless to say, the members of Congress are involved in all of this in the take. We got at least 100 members of the administration who are tied into the Clinton Foundation. So I've done nothing about it. I've got Nick Kohlerstrom, who's the world's leading expert on the 7/7 London subway bombings, who did work on the Israeli complicity in 9/11. Then I got Preston James, who's a PhD social psychologist and expert on the complexities of the cover-up, who goes through the many layers of the cover-up. Alan Sabrowski, who was the director of the studies for the Strategic Studies Institute at the U.S. Army War College, talking about the role of Israel in 9/11 and who was involved. And then Stephen Francis, with whom I organized this, putting 9/11 within a broader cultural context of Zionism in a session entitled 9/11 and Cultural Marxism. I'm telling you, this is really an extraordinary conference. I can't believe how well it came together.
I just posted you a link in the chat there from the New York Sun, a 2008 article that admits over 60 hotspots were found in downtown Manhattan. This is a radiological survey done in 2008, or 2007 actually, and published in 2008.
Yeah.
This almost just about admits that these places had hot radiological zones, even 6 years after the event of 9/11.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And of course, we have all these medical maladies, multiple myeloma, leukemia, lymphoma, pancreatic, esophageal, blood and plasma, all kinds of weird cancers that are associated with exposure to ionizing radiation, where the total affected now includes 64,000 in one program and 18 in another. I mean, it's about 70,000 victims of these debilitating diseases that are further effects of the fact that it was done with mini or micro nukes.
And of course, this boils down to FEMA allowing the people, Christina Whitman, I believe was her name, from that to allow people to go down.
Saying the air was safe to breathe. Did I mention before they actually brought in prisoners from fresh kills and had them picking up what was supposed to be asbestos with their bare hands when it was all radioactively contaminated?
Wow.
Oh, it's absolutely disgusting. And, would you believe Sputnik News, which is probably right now the foremost international news site, picked up on the conference and published an article about it.
Right. And how well received was that from the people that went there? Have you had people come up to you and say, you've just blown my mind? You know,
I've been so busy talking with you and doing these other things that I haven't spent a lot of time on the comments. But I mean, I'm telling you, this stuff is powerful stuff. This is the single best conference ever held on 9/11. There's no doubt about it. And I've organized quite a few of them myself. One in Madison in 2007, one in London in 2010, the one in Vancouver in 2012. I've been flown around the world to talk about 9/11 in 2006 in December. My wife and I were flown all expense paid to Athens, put on a TV for 3.5 hours, and broadcast worldwide by satellite. Maybe the single most sensational program ever done on 9/11, because they had done so much wonderful work of preparing all these film clips. They had a panel of 12, and I was told going in that most of them won't say anything. And I said, not today. And of course, I was right. Every one of them had a question to ask. It's very funny. I know a woman in New York, and I showed her the DVD of the 3.5 hour broadcast. And there was one fellow there who was a publisher and was wearing a 3-piece suit. And I said to her, I think he was CIA. And she looked at it and it was her uncle. And she said, we always thought he was CIA. I mean, I'm telling you, some of these funny things. Then wow. did I tell you I was flown down to Argentina in 2008 to give a series of lectures about JFK and 9/11, brought back in 2009 to give the keynote address for an international symposium on 9/11 Truth and Justice, which was held in the library of the Republic of Argentina. And they
make it sound extradition treaty.
And they had like 20 cameras there. I mean, there were like 200 dignitaries and 20 cameras. Where I gave the keynote address. Kurt Sonnenfeld, who was the FEMA videographer in New York City, was there. He fled to New York because he was being prosecuted for the death of his wife.
Kurt Sonnenfeld, yes.
Yeah, which I appear to me to have been a frame. But he's got a lovely wife and kids down there, and she was actually my translator when I gave my presentation. So he also spoke. And I think it was Jason Burness, from Loose Change, was down there too. He was also a speaker.
The September 11, 15th anniversary.
The fact that you actually are so thoroughly immersed in 9/11, you know such a great deal about it.
Well, if you're going to make interview people on the topic, you got to know what you're talking about, I guess.
Well, yeah, that's certainly a nice thought. And as I may have mentioned before, as a professor, I appreciate when my students do their homework, and you obviously have done yours.
Is it not possible there could be a combination of both nanothermite used to shear the building and make it walk, as well as these micro-nuke devices used in conjunction? That would explain how the actual lengths of the steel was the appropriate size for the flatbed trucks that they'd hired beforehand. Is it not possible that they could have been used in conjunction with the micro-nukes themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, in the Midwest 9/11 Truth Conference, Chuck Baldwin talks about the use of nanothermite in combination with mini or micro nukes, and makes what I think is actually a rather persuasive case that that's how it was done.
And the evidence.
The problem isn't nanothermite. The problem is nanothermite cannot have done it on its own. And when you got an organization that's scarfing up all this money from the public, nanothermite isn't sufficient. All they have done with all the money and resources they have and these thousands of engineers and architects is bring us nanothermite and Building 7. Well, that ain't enough. Nanothermite doesn't cut it. Building 7 is too obvious. They won't talk about who is responsible and why. They're clearly running a limited hangout. That's the problem. I don't object that nanothermite played a role here, but it's not a sufficient explanation. It can't explain the phenomena. That's the whole idea. You got these buildings blowing apart in every direction from the top down. You got them being converted into millions of cubic yards of very, very fine dust, which, by the way, is a typical signature of a nuclear event. You got no stack of debris in their footprint. Then, in addition, it turns out we have the U.S. Geological Survey, dust studies of barium, strontium, lithium, lanthanum, and the like, and then all these cases, up to 70,000 of medical maladies that are associated with exposure to ionizing radiation. How can architects and engineers not acknowledge that all of this evidence adds up to a nuclear event, which was done, therefore, in combination with nanothermite? That's the point. They only talk about nanothermite. They don't talk about nukes, because that would be too provocative. That might get the people upset. It might cause them to want to know who in God's name could have nuked New York on 9/11.
Yeah, that they will never, ever question that American government could ever do that to their own people. But we're not talking
and
nukes.
It's actually in collusion with the Mossad, because this appears to have been done by taking Davy Crockett warheads. These were tactical newts for an early recoilless rifle that were given to Israel in a large number, it would appear, that the Israelis then reworked them and brought them back to be used in New York to blow apart the Twin Towers.
Of course, that demolition had to be planned long in advance, because these towers were unconventionally high, and they would have had to have had a demolition plan of how to bring them down.
The key aspect, which practically no one in 9/11 understands, is they had to demolish them in such a way that no significant portion of them came down in the bathtub, which was an enormous dike or moat within which they were built to keep Hudson River water out, because had that happened, had any major portion of these 500,000-ton buildings shattered the bathtub, then lower Manhattan would have been flooded. It's beneath its foundations. The subway tunnels, path trade tunnel, would have been a horrible mess. So they had to figure out an ingenious method of demolition that would preserve the bathtub. And that's why they came up with this very elaborate plan.
To point one finger at any one group, would you consider that the Carlyle Group, the investment house, had a major role in that? Do you mention the Carlyle Group in your book at all?
Actually, that's very, very interesting. I wouldn't be surprised at all that the Carlyle Group had a role. We principally addressed the members of the Project for a New American Century who had come in, the Zionists in the world, in the Port Authority, and ICTS and Urban Moving Systems, and the other elements that were involved as the players on 9/11. But I agree. I think that's a really interesting point that the Carlyle Group was there in the background and probably made a fat. Well, You know, Cheney was so eager to get Halliburton into Iraq, you see. I mean, basically, they privatized the military and parts of the government to get these private corporations in where they would make trillions of money at taxpayer expense. So the taxpayer is pocketing out trillions. There are companies there that are making trillions, but they're not the ones who are shelling out. You know, it really is a shell game, as Scott Bennett described. So he goes into a great deal about the financial aspects of 9/11, but was not in the book. Not in the book. So, I mean, it's one of these cases where the deeper you go, you know, more evidence pops out. And at any one point in time, you can anticipate that, as is characteristic of a true hypothesis in science, it can have more confirming instances the further you go.
In a lot of these false flags, one of the things as a good researcher I do is straight away get as much evidence and get as many website links and proof of picture from the mainstream media as possible. And 9 times out of 10, that story will suddenly disappear, or you have to go and screen capture it from another source. A lot of this stuff just gets wiped down the memory hole. Have you seen that happen through the years, where stuff just gets buried underneath all this mountain of other stuff that gets poured on top of it?
Steve, could you make that point again? It somehow slipped by me. Stuff that gets buried under other stuff when you have new discoveries. I mean, that clearly can happen, but it's important. That's a reason why it's important to document your discoveries in the form of a semi-permanent archive, like a book. I mean, I think books really are important, and it turns out that books are practically... The time when issues or research are taken seriously is when we have books.
I've seen a lot of research go missing off the internet, and pages that have disappeared over the years that had vital stories and clues to this. Haven't you seen that happen yourself?
Well, I mean, you know, I've seen the very, very, very dramatic situation of having... my Sandy Hook book banned by Amazon.com. I mean, you can't get worse than that for them trying to ban it. As soon as they banned it, though, it was obvious to me it was political. So what I did was to go ahead and release it for free as a PDF to the public. I have a friend who follows these things, and while we might have expected, say, to have sold maybe 8,000 copies of the book, whatever, he has seen millions of people searching for the free PDF, which you can still obtain today.
And what other books have you got in the pipeline at the moment? You said you had 34 and 35. What are the titles of those books?
Well, 34 is From Orlando to Dallas and Beyond, because it's unbelievable. In Orlando, the license to run the club had expired three years ago. In 2013, it only had a legal occupancy of 150. It only had parking for about 11 spaces, none for handicap. If you had 50 killed and 53 injured, then there should have been abandoned vehicles all over the place because their drivers were either dead or hospitalized. None of that happened because the whole thing was a completely staged event. I have a correspondent who resides in the area who wrote to tell me that the Pulse wasn't even a gay club. And just to show the complicity of the hospitals, they have announced they're not going to bill anyone who was involved in the shooting, which would have been a scam because, you know, no one actually was shot or killed at the Orlando. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Wow. You're saying that was one big stage setup?
Yeah, absolutely. And then, Dallas is equally ridiculous. It turns out that very famous photograph of a group of police officers beside what looks like a very high wall with a couple of enormous columns shooting upward was published in the Wall Street Journal too early, so that a student out in Seattle picked up the paper at midnight, but working backwards realized this was, with preternatural speed to get the photograph processed and put into print and all the editing and the story and all that. Something was wrong. And when we looked into it, we discovered they had to print it because it was Photoshop. What they had done was to take the background, and we have photographs of the background. The wall is really not all that high. The columns actually are cut off about 3 feet high, whereas they looked enormous and monumental. So they took a photograph of the background, they blew it up, and then they impose the figures of these police officers. We also have video of the police officers at that location at that time, and they're not the same officers in the photograph.
So what we're living in an Orwellian Ministry of Information type era.
100%. It just came a little late. It wasn't 1984. It came around, you know, 2001 and since. I mean, you know, it's ridiculous. 9/11 was all scripted, fabricated. None of the planes crashed. The buildings were destroyed as part of an urban renewal project. So Larry Silverstein could replace them with a new, you know, they had so much trouble rebuilding because of the residue of the radioactive contamination. They had to build these fountains in the footprints where the north and the south tower had stood.
Yeah, the very basics of what you're saying, Professor Fetzer, is we're not waiting for the New World Order to come. It's here well and truly already.
that's right. You're actually right. You're right. Wow. It's just formalized by the TPP, which would be god-awful because it would terminate the sovereignty of the United States.
As if it hasn't been terminated already? I mean, big companies moving out?
The TPP creates a board of corporate attorneys who have the right to override the laws or statutes of any of the 14 Pacific Rim nations, thereby subsumed, including the Constitution of the United States.
It's interesting when Halliburton has their head office in Saudi Arabia, you know things are happening and things are moving out of the country.
You're right on top of so many aspects of this. I love it. Very, very good.
Well, the things we're seeing in the news media, we only get told about 10% of what actually happens behind the scenes. And a lot of that stuff gets filtered out, especially with ancient technology and ancient histories. One time working on a mine site in remote northern territory, I had to sign a waiver that if I found any ancient civilization remains, I'd have to keep my mouth shut, like a non-disclosure treaty, just to be on the mine site. And I was thinking, my God, what are they expecting to find out here? But truly, the place we were working was almost prehistoric, and putting in a gold mine slap back in the middle of it. Yeah, lots of fun.
Well, you really are excellent and unusually knowledgeable and well-informed host. That impresses me a lot, Steve.
It makes me wonder how much of this ancient stuff is actually found day to day and just hidden by the powers that be and the Smithsonian Institute and all the voices of the CIA that have their seeds everywhere. That's part of the tentacles of the octopus, if you like. That they're all a division of another company or the same product on the supermarket shelf with just different
layers. Yes. Hillary would be an extension, but you know the fact that her health problems, curiously enough,
If she can stand up long enough.
Well, let me finish the thought. Her stumbling today and this disappearance, rushing her off in this ambulance, just concealed or camouflaged as an SUV, is going to have a lot of ripple effects, including Americans coming to realize that the media isn't really doing its job and we're being lied to and deceived. We have a professor of medicine who has reviewed Hillary's case and who is saying she has less than a year to live. I was so struck by this, I made the article, I republished it as a blog. So if you go to jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, the first two are going to be part two and part one of the Midwest 9/11 Truth Conference. Then the third is this professor of medicine talking about the dire state of Hillary's health. And all this is beginning to unravel because of her leaving the 9/11 ceremonial event today prematurely, her stumbling and seeming to faint when she was being helped into her ambulance, camouflaged as an SUV, allegedly going to Chelsea's apartment for an hour and a half, and then having her come out. And I was really astonished because there was no security with her, making her look really chipper after they've somehow shot her up with whatever it is that's keeping her on 2 feet. But this professor of medicine is convinced, and many other doctors are speaking up. There are six or eight now, some of whom, of course, are being severely punished, like this Dr. Pinsky, who had his show on CNN, I believe, who was fired. He had his show terminated because he raised questions about Hillary's health. This just shows – what a total control freak she is and the extent of her power, that she can have somebody who simply raises questions about her health fired. Then the Huffington Post did the same thing with a guy named Seaman, S-E-A-M-A-N. He published an article about her health, and the Huffington Post took it down and canceled his posting privileges. I mean, this is very, very bad. I mean, these are all violations of freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of inquiry, and about a matter of immense magnitude. What is the state of health of the leading candidate to become president of the United States? It turns out to be deplorable.
Not good at all.
Not good at all.
Is there any chance in the future of a Jim Fetzer-sponsored 9/11 Truth Music Festival ever happening? The very first 9/11 Truth Music Festival, something like that.
That's very curious, because people have sent me several 9/11 songs and so forth, and I have to confess I've never really got into it, but it would be an interesting idea. Maybe that's something we should contemplate doing. Steve, you and I could coordinate a 9/11 music festival, invite people to submit their compositions.
It's spreading the music far and wide and spreading the message as well, and getting into another vein. And surely that's got to be the thing.
We could do it on your show. We could have the, you know, see how many submissions we get and play them.
I'm talking about a Woodstock-type festival, 9/11 Truth Music Festival, you know, that kind of thing.
Where are we going to have $500,000 on Max Jaeger's farm?
yeah, we could have...
That's a nice thought, but that's a complete fantasy. You know, you have any ideas?
Jason Burmes on DJ. We could have a few, you know, big names doing their rapping thing on the mic.
It's a great idea, but, you know, I would not be in the position to orchestrate it. But, you know, I mean, I'd be glad to give advice and possibly even participate if someone else were to take the bull by. I've organized these conferences, but I've also lost money. I lost $10,000 on the Madison. I lost $10,000 on the Vancouver. This is because I was flying in the speakers and giving them accommodations. You see, I was doing it first class. But my wife takes a dim view of me dropping $10,000 on a conference, so that I'm under very severe constraints as to what I can and cannot do. If somebody isn't flying me to give a speech and so forth and covering my expenses, I'm forbidden for doing it.
Well, me personally, I would pay $50 to see Kevin Barrett on the bongos.
See, that's where I had an ingenious solution to putting together these conferences on academic freedom and on 9/11 by directly interviewing them and putting them together. So I was the orchestrator, because I knew the sequence, I knew who I wanted, I knew what they could contribute. And when I put them together, it's really astonishingly powerful.
The Jim Fetzer Orchestra, the Truth Orchestra. You put it all together, like the symphony of truth. That's beautiful.
There you go.
Well, I'd like to hear that expressed in a musical form, you know, because it all leads to something bigger, and it only needs to start off with one or two bands and get them together and hand out pamphlets and whatever, and little things grow into big things. Don't you agree?
Yeah, can, most certainly.
You know, there's an analogy I use, as in the snowflake. It is very, very fragile, and it can melt in the hand. But one or two snowflakes can't really make a difference. But when those snowflakes get together and create a snowball and it creates an avalanche, you can move the side of mountains and basically overrun anything on the side of a mountain. And that becomes a powerful movement just from a few snowflakes.
Yes, yes, yes. And I got to admit, I was so involved in putting together the 9/11 Midwest Truth Conference, which I wanted to have up on Saturday, and managed to bring that about, that I was up late hours, and, you know, for about a week in putting the whole thing together. But I think it worked.
You've had a lot of support since then, and a lot of people congratulating you and sending you congratulatory emails.
Oh, well, I think it's too early. I mean, you got 14 sessions, some of which are 2 hours. And it takes a while for people to go through it all. I think I'm going to get a lot of response beginning next week, I have no doubt. But, I mean, having been in this 9/11 thing for 10 years, I know the the worth of what is presented in that conference, and it's pure spun gold for those who are interested in the truth of 9/11.
And asking more questions.
Yeah. But I'll tell you, given the way we're doing this, would it be okay with you if I send you the rest of this now? Did you get the first part? I put it actually right into Skype.
Yes, sir. That's fine.
Would that be okay?
Yeah, of course.
I'm starting to run out of gas. You know, I've got another hour to do yet.
Okay. We should let you go and refresh maybe. Come back.
Yeah. I'll come back another time. I'm gonna now render this for you, and I'll send it to you, Steve.
Certainly. Thanks very much for your time there, Professor Fetzer, sir.
My great pleasure. I really appreciate your having me on the show.
It always is a pleasure, and good luck with the book. I hope you sell a lot of copies.
Thanks very much. Well, I use it to publish other books and to support worthy projects like the Legal Defense Fund for James Tracy and
right.
And getting Ole Domegaard to an assassination conference on JFK and things like that.
That's just fantastic.
Terrific. I'm rendering it now.
Okay. Bye for now.
Thanks. Yeah, I'll put it right into Skype, okay?
Thank you, sir.
You got it. My pleasure, Steve.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.